Hello, everybody. I'm your host, Edward Holiday, and I'd like to welcome you to the first ever episode of The Haunted Roadmap. Ever since I was a young boy, I've been obsessed with the stories and folktales that keep you up into the wee hours of the night. And my mission with this podcast is to compile a list of stories and places that strike the imagination and make you think twice about turning off those lights. And with that, let's find our first destination. Here we see a forgotten cemetery, a place of rest for the souls of yesteryear. But underneath this quiet necropolis lie some inhabitants that refuse to cross over to the other side. Its name, Peace Church Cemetery, and it's located just 5 miles outside of the heart of Joplin, Missouri. And it's our first stop on the Haunted Roadmap. What you're about to find is a roadmap. A simple piece of cartography. A sheet of paper of lost places and forgotten memories, whose mysteries entice the senses of those with a knack for the macabre and unusual. As you embark on this trip ahead, make sure to stick to the Haunted Roadmap. This episode is brought to you by Kraken Media in partnership with the What's Haunting Foundation, expanding and investing in the cultivation and research of parascience and the esoteric arts for 3 generations now. And now, back to the show. Peace Church Cemetery is an old cemetery, with gravestones dating back to 1846. Its overgrown and forgotten appearance reminds you of a place lost to the modern world around it. Here, the bodies of 1,200 souls rest in eternal slumber, with approximately 400 of them being the souls of children. Some say that on dark nights, you can hear the laughter of these children as they frolic through the gravestones. Peace Church is also the resting ground for many American soldiers, entombed in wars as early as the Civil War to the Korean. It is in a time of war, just outside the gates of Peace Church Cemetery, that we find our first story. The day is May 18th, 1863, 2 years into the brutal war that would pit brother against brother, a war fought for the very idea of what it is to be American. Here, on the Missouri-Kansas border, a group of Union soldiers from the 1st Colored Infantry comb the land for food and supplies. Many of them are former slaves who have fled to the free state of Kansas before the conflict arose. Their search brings them to the Raider homestead with its vast stocks of corn. And there, the soldiers seize their opportunity as they begin to collect valuable supplies to bring back to their camp at Baxter Springs, Kansas. These men would have no idea of the slaughter that was about to befall them in the coming moments. As the men load stock after stock of corn into their wagons, an adversary approaches from the distance on horseback. 70 men of the Southern Guerrilla Forces, led by Confederate Major Tom Livingston, rush towards the unsuspecting soldiers. Perhaps we can, if we put ourselves into those soldiers' places. Imagine the panic faced by the foraging party as they heard the horses' brays draw ever closer. The men, with adrenaline pumping through their veins, rushed for their weapons, but found themselves out of time. Livingston's forces had already descended upon top of them. Panicked, the Union soldiers flee, abandoning their supplies, in a desperate and chaotic rush across the border. It's said these Confederate soldiers chased these men for 8 long miles. And by the time the men had made it back to Baxter Springs, nearly half of the initial party was missing, gunned down over the gruesome 8-mile rapid withdrawal. As dawn broke over the camp the next day, retaliation was on the minds of many soldiers. As the Union returned to the scene of the slaughter, they found that many of their men had not just been killed, but violently and inhumanely mutilated like animals. It was then that a few men arrested John Bishop, a Southern sympathizer who had assisted the Confederate guerrillas at Raider's Farm. Bishop was tried on the spot, and sentenced to execution. A few local sources state that he was shot and set ablaze along the remaining bodies inside of Raider's farmhouse. Some say John Bishop was still alive and screaming when the house was engulfed in flames. From the Raider's homestead, the Union Army moved northwest towards the town of Sherwood, a known Confederate guerrilla haven in the region, and the third largest town in Jasper County. There, the armies would wage a scorched earth policy on all of the 250 inhabitants, burning their homes and businesses. Sherwood would never be built again, and stays to this day as a haunting reminder of one of America's darkest conflicts. Many stories of haunted graveyards often tell the tale of a person whose acts were so heinous that burial on a consecrated ground seems unacceptable. And so, they must be buried outside the perimeter of a churchyard. For many convicted of devil worship, witchcraft, murder, and suicide, burial outside of these holy grounds are the closest that they'll come to resting with their loved ones. There, they're forced to wander for eternity, looking for a semblance of their waking life. Peace Church Cemetery has one of these residents, ever stalking the region just outside the gates of the old cemetery grounds. His is a tale of vengeance and the open road. And his actions have been the thing of legend for both song and the silver screen. This devil from Joplin has one moniker that many know him by today. And that moniker is The Hitchhiker. America is filled with highways. Like veins, they stretch across the continent, providing the lifeblood for countless numbers of folklores. These seemingly endless and vast tracts of pavement provide both freedom and danger for modern travelers, seeking the thrill of adventure and the unknown. But in 1950, a monster stalked the highways and byways of the open road. Not a beast like the skinwalkers of the American Southwest, or the werewolves of legends, but a flesh and blood maniac, angry at the world he was brought into. His deeds were later pinned into the last dying recordings of the iconic 1960s band, The Doors, in their final song, Riders on the Storm, a fever dream of the immortal Jim Morrison. But this writer himself was no fiction of Morrison's vivid imagination. His actions stretch back nearly two decades prior. Billy Cook Jr., or as he was later known by Time magazine as The Hitchhiking Killer, was responsible for a number of brutal kidnappings and murders between his home state of Missouri and California between the winter of 1950 and 1951. His life was one of vengeance and malice, not avidly known by spectators who viewed the wholesome era of 1950s America. But what drives a man to such violence and such rage? And more importantly to this podcast, what does it have to do with Peace Church Cemetery? William Cook Jr. was born on December 23rd, 1928, to poor Missouri parents in Joplin. Although little is known about Billy's formative years, we do have insight into a few key misfortunes that possibly influenced his formative years as a young man. At the age of five, Billy's mother would pass away unexpectedly, leaving his father, a local railroad worker, in a difficult position of being the sole parent and provider to Billy and his seven siblings. But fate would continue to be unkind to Billy and his siblings. His father would have little time to deal with the responsibilities of parenthood, opting instead to leaving the family in an abandoned mine shaft with little provisions to care for themselves. As time would pass, Billy would see his father less and less, until one day, his father stopped coming altogether. Eventually, a prison psychologist would speak to Billy about his time in the mineshaft. And upon extended analysis, the doctor believed that Billy likely witnessed his father murder his mother and then discard the children into that mineshaft. As time passed, state authorities would find the abandoned Cook children and quickly rehome them in various foster homes around Missouri. All that is, except Billy. Whether it was his deformed eye or belligerent attitude, most likely the latter, Billy found himself a ward of the state. And by 1941, Billy had already acquired a small rap sheet of petty crimes and was eventually arrested on a truancy count. It was at this point that Billy was transferred to the Missouri State Training School for Boys, a place he himself would choose over foster care. Here he would stay until 1943, when he was arrested yet again and sentenced to 5 years in Boonville Prison on an assault charge. Eventually, he was transferred to the Missouri State Maximum Security Penitentiary in Jefferson City at the age of 17 for a failed escape from Boonville Prison. But while inside, his violent temper did not subdue. It's said that while he was locked up in the state pen, Cook assaulted a fellow inmate with a baseball bat in a fit of rage. By 1950, Billy was a free man again. The 21-year-old made his way back to Joplin, where he reconnected with his estranged father for a brief while. His desire, in his own words, would be to live by the gun and roam. Setting out from Missouri, he drifted between California and Texas, scratching a living doing odd jobs like dishwashing along the way. While making his way through Texas, Billy acquired his signature .32 stub-nosed revolver, which would become his weapon of intimidation in many of his future crimes. It was here in Texas that Billy would begin his notorious journey that would immortalize him to this day. On December 30th, 1950, a man by the name of L.B. Arthur, a local mechanic, pulled over to pick Billy up alongside the road outside of Lubbock, Texas. After a brief encounter, Billy proceeded to rob Arthur of $100 by pulling his revolver on him. He then forced Arthur into the trunk of his own car. Arthur would eventually escape the car by wedging the trunk open with a crowbar and disappearing down a few side roads. Mr. Arthur was lucky to have escaped the car with his life. Unfortunately, not everyone that would meet Billy would be so lucky. The car Billy stole would eventually run out of gas in Oklahoma. There, Cook would once again pose as a hitchhiker along the open road. A few days later, Billy would see his path cross 33-year-old Illinois farmer by the name of Carl Moser, who had been traveling to New Mexico with his wife Thelma and their three children, Ronald, Gary, and Pamela. For the next 72 hours, Billy would terrorize the Mosers, forcing them at gunpoint to drive all over the American West, eventually ending back in Joplin, Missouri. Perhaps out of fear of getting caught, or the sense of time running out, Billy unloaded his revolver into the family, killing all five of the Mosers, as well as their family dog. He then proceeded to dump the bodies in an abandoned mineshaft, located not far from the intersection of 3rd and Oliver in present-day Joplin, Missouri. He then loaded himself back into the family car and set off for Oklahoma, eventually dumping the car outside of Tulsa. The Moser family would be found a few days later by local police. Upon examining the body, the authorities found a receipt for a gun purchased in El Paso, Texas. It was later discovered that the receipt had belonged to a man named William Cook Jr. Billy was now a wanted fugitive on the run from the law. But Billy, at this point, was a master of the highway and made his way back to California. There, outside of Blythe, California, on January 6th, 1951, Billy kidnapped a deputy sheriff by the name of Homer Waldrop. And for the next few hours, Billy had Officer Waldrop drive him around at gunpoint yet again. Finally, after a long and aimless drive, in which Billy regaled the tales of killing the Moser family, Billy ordered the officer to stop in the middle of the California desert. Billy forced the officer out of the car and bound him. There, in a ditch at gunpoint, Officer Waldrop was told he would be executed. But in a bizarre turn of kindness, Billy decided not to kill Deputy Sheriff Homer that evening, instead opting to leave him stranded alone in the desert. It's said that Billy told the officer that he had met his wife while working as a dishwasher in California, and that she was the only one who had ever, and I quote, treated him like a human being and had been nicer to him than anyone had ever been to him in his entire life. And for that, he would spare the officer's life. Billy would leave Officer Waldrop tied up in the middle of the desert, but drove off in his police cruiser. A few hours later that night, Cook would come across Robert Dewey, a salesman from Seattle, traveling in Southern California. Using the police cruiser, he pulled Dewey over. After kidnapping the man, a brief skirmish would break out between Cook and Dewey, ending with Dewey's unfortunate demise. Billy would leave Robert Dewey's body in a ditch and made his way back to Blythe in Dewey's maroon sedan. Seeing his options running thin, Billy would yet again resort to kidnapping. This time, however, it would be his last. Two hunters by the name of James Burke and Forrest Dameron were coming back from a long trip in the woods. Here, Cook would lure the two men into his vehicle and force them to drive him south, past the border of Mexico. On January 15th, 1951, Billy Cook's rampage of murder would come to an end in Santa Rosalie, Mexico, when Police Chief Louis Parra would recognize a young man that fit Cook's description. After disarming him of his snub-nosed pistol, Cook was taken into custody by the Mexican authorities and later handed over to the FBI. Once he was extradited back to the States, Cook was charged with 300 years in prison by an Oklahoma court for the murder of the Moser family. He was then given the death penalty in California for the death of Robert Dewey. On December 12, 1952, Billy was executed in San Quentin's famous gas chamber. In an interview with Life magazine shortly before his death, Cook said, "Girls never liked me, and I won the respect of men only by my fist." After the execution, Cook's body would pass for a short time to an Oklahoma funeral director, who would eventually post his body up along Route 66 as a roadside attraction. People from all over would pay a nickel to spectate the body of the infamous hitchhiking killer. Eventually, Billy's sister would acquire the body and lay him to rest in a secret ceremony just outside of the gates of Peace Church Cemetery. A spectator, Gerald Wallace of the Joplin Globe, would report of the ceremony. Just as the rite had ended, the cry of a small child could be heard in the chill of the night air. And there he waits, night after night, for a new victim to stalk. And as we're out here, let's hope that we're not one of them. And now, as the hours creep deeper and deeper into the night, we must leave Peace Church and its immortal inhabitants. Let's hope that someday they find the rest that they so desperately seek. I myself am going to go home strike up a match, light some sage, and await the next waypoint to appear on the map. And if you're from the Joplin area and have some personal experience with Peace Church Cemetery, I myself would love to hear about it. You can always email your stories to hauntedroadmap@gmail.com or join our Discord. And for those of you in other parts of the world, I'd love to hear your stories too. Who knows? Perhaps the next waypoint will be in your hometown. Good night, everyone out there. Stay safe in this darkness, and I hope you join us next time as we take to the road again on the Haunted Roadmap.
The Haunted Roadmap is a production of Kraken Media, with voice performances by Edward Holliday and Wes Potts. A special thanks goes out to our musical talent, Alex Kahneman of TV Magic, who wrote our intro song as well as all of our background tracks. And our show script was written and edited by Wesley Potts and Chloe Massengale.